This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Picture yourself on a deserted beach, bearing the scars of years of erosion, where the scattered bones of a once thriving village bake in the sun. More than seven decades ago, dozens of homes once stood on that same sandy shoreline. As paddy fields and the surrounding areas became inundated by salt water, one by one, people left the village. The place is Kuala Pa'amat in Kota Baru, Kelantan, where Major General Hiroshi Takumi led the first Japanese landing on Malaya. The ensuing battle proved to be a turning point in World War II and a major catalyst in both Malaysian and regional history. Today, several kilometers of the beach have been swallowed by the sea, erasing a tremendous part of its history. Any remnants of that great battle have long disappeared with the tide, lying still in their watery graves. I'm Nadia Aziz, and you're listening to the first episode in our new series on heritage and culture and all things Malaysian. From the late 1930s, Malaya was the resource of 40% of the world's rubber and 60% of the world's tin. Most of these commodities went to Japan's cross-ocean rival, the United States. Malaya also proved a perfect point to launch a further invasion to the oil-rich islands of Borneo, Java, and Sumatra, with Japan also needing oil supplies for its military and industrial capacities. The Empire of the Rising Sun had been fighting China for 4 years in the Second Sino-Japanese War, expanding the country's influence politically and militarily to secure access to raw material reserves and other economic resources. This was after decades of imperialist policy, culminating with Prime Minister Hideki Tojo's rule and with the order from Emperor Showa. Once starved of resources and refused supplies from the US, Britain and the Netherlands, the country looked to Southeast Asia to make up for the shortfall. Being one of the richest jewels in the British imperial crown sealed Malaya's fate. It was December 8th in the year 1941. It was barely past midnight in Kelantan, well into the year-end monsoon season. Despite heavy waves and bad weather, a Japanese convoy of ships appeared on the Badang and Sabak beaches in Kota Baru, consisting of three large transport vessels, escorted by five Sendai light cruisers and a squadron of destroyers. I'm speaking to Zafrani Arifin from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club.
Actually, it happened 1 hour and 50 minutes before the attack on Pearl Harbor, which is more famous worldwide. But for this event, like unknown, because it being in the shadow of the Pearl Harbor event, so it's a shame to know that, because it's even more important because it's the first one in the Pacific War. And so many people died, including many Japanese, hundreds of them. Japanese should know this because it's the war that begins for their own Pacific War, not the Pearl Harbor attack. Many people forget about that. So we are trying to show the forgotten history.
Zafrani, from what I understand, you're planning to write a book about the landing in Kota Baru. Now, you've obviously done a lot of research into the matter. Can you explain to those who are not so familiar with what exactly happened that day, why Kota Baru? Why was Kota Baru so important for the Japanese invasion?
They chose to attack Kota Baru because Kota Baru was the focal point of the British defense, which was the Air Force. The Air Force was the main defense for the Malaya strategy. So when the Royal Air Force and Royal Australian Air Force were based in Kota Baru, can attack the Japanese on the sea when they were approaching, that could be a very decisive moment. If the British were successful, the attack on Malaya would be resolved and Malaya would be safe. So that's why the Japanese attacked Kota Baru first, to destroy the British airfield and capture the airfield to use by their own Air Force to attack Singapore and elsewhere.
And how strong were the British and Australian forces there?
The British had 3 airfields in Malaya, Kota Baru Airfield, Machang Airfield and Gokudak. So these airfields are supposed to be watching over the coast of Malaya from the north, where the Japanese were expected to came. So they have great defence in Kelantan, actually, all over the coast, from Tumpat to the Besut border with Terengganu. So they have about 5,000 soldiers in Kelantan.
The defences of Malaya, constantly tested, have been continually growing in strength. Malaya is about the same size as England, but it's mostly jungle. Here, troops are practicing camouflage in comparatively open country near an estate on the edge of the jungle.
The British prepared months in advance, with Lieutenant General Arthur Percival overseeing the construction of pillboxes at every 500-metre interval along the beach, behind 3 lines of barbed wire fencing with landmines buried around the fences. The defending army, including soldiers from the Indian Infantry of Punjabi descent and Australian Air Forces, held off a first and second wave of attacks, the Japanese suffering heavy losses. By the end of the day, however, Kota Baru had fallen. Several attempts throughout the day to retake the area also failed, and within 10 days, the Japanese had taken the entire state of Kelantan. By mid-January, the Japanese troops had already reached Johor, and the Battle of Malaya and the British Empire ended with the surrender of Singapore on February 15, 1942. Quite frankly, the British were outmaneuvered. So this was the focal point of the British Air Forces, manned by a substantial number of people, but they still lost Kota Baru.
Yes, because the width of the beach defence is so long, fewer men to man all the defence line. So that means the defensive line were thinner than supposed to be. When the Japanese attack with great numbers at one point, they can penetrate through superior number. So that's why they managed to be victorious in Kota Baru.
General Percival was in command at the time, but even though he built defences all over the beach, and after months of preparations, he still resisted making the first move.
Yes, they see the ship were coming from the South Vietnam towards Kota Baru, but because at the time they were in the declaration of war, so they can't do anything. If they attack first, they would be doing something wrong without international declaration of war. So they were unable to do anything. The Japanese, they were so sure about winning the war, so without declaration of war, they just attack, and that's why they win. If they lost this attack, the empire will be lost the war.
Japanese aggression has once again become headline news. Not because of anything fresh in China, but because the new Japanese government is a full-blooded, militaristic, pro-Axis government. General Tojo says Japan will continue to work for the prosperity of all the peoples of Asia.
The Japanese had prepared in advance for the invasion, setting up local agents in strategic locations. These agents were tasked with befriending the local villagers, gaining their trust and friendship, and uncovering much-needed intel before the arrival of the Imperial Army. And by proposing independence from their colonial masters, the local Malays were easily roped in, as there were already groups working to gain independence from their British colonial masters.
Actually, the Japanese have some spies network in Malaya at the time. Mostly, they were selling food to the locals. They mostly like barber. Nobody suspect that they are actually spies. And they also recruit the local because they want to get their assistance. And they also want the people to realize that they are fighting for their own freedom. Actually, they were just being used, actually.
But the Japanese strategy wasn't foolproof, was it? I mean, they suffered massive losses on that day.
There were many Japanese soldiers who were drowned in the sea when their landing craft were shot by the British. And at the time, there were a big wave because there was monsoon. And when they landed, they were under fire by the British from machine gun, firing from the pillbox and artillery and even aircraft. They're attacking all over the beachhead.
So the simultaneous attacks made sure no reinforcements came.
Actually, the Japanese planned to attack the entire Pacific War at the same time. One of the reasons is to cause confusion for the allies, you know. Is it the real one attack? Is it the actual attack? So when the surprise attack happened everywhere in the Pacific, they were shocked and cannot react. So that's why they were beaten in Pearl Harbor. They were smashed in Pearl Harbor and Hong Kong, everywhere. even Thailand, especially in Malaya, in Kelantan, where they happened the first battle.
Many villagers' lives were saved that day, thanks to warnings by the Dogra Indian soldiers and by Japanese agents that had assimilated into village life in Kampung Pa Amat. During the attack, locals were told to dig trenches under their homes to save themselves, clawing the sandy earth with their bare hands to escape the hail of fire. They were also advised not to retreat to the railway bridge in Kusiau, where any escaping villagers might have been mistaken for invading soldiers and shot on sight by British and Australian forces. The four-year Japanese occupation, however, would eventually see an estimated 100,000 people killed by the invading army's brutality. The Rising Sun's forces were made up of mostly hardened veterans from the war in China, when many war crimes were committed. Decades later, the Japanese still remember their part in the war, despite the time period being glossed over in the country's history books.
Some group, including Professor Takashima, he brought many Japanese teachers to show them how the Japanese did the cruelty in the Malaya by showing all the graves where they massacred the people here. They came and when they go back to Japan, they teach their children or their students what really happened. Because in Japan, they are not in the school books. The government didn't teach these things. You know? School books or textbooks, all the pain and suffering. It doesn't shine through textbook, actually. We have to go to the place themselves to see how it was and to feel the atmosphere of the place. Then you know how it was.
What about modern-day Japan? There's still the belief that the country liberated Asia from colonialists, but do they understand what happened during the actual Japanese occupation?
Some of them didn't know about that, but some do know. Some of them, like their own family, came to Kota Bharu to pray for their father's spirit, and also some other historian who are more nationalist in spirit, not to support the war, but to support their own country during the war because they are supposed to be nationalistic. Some Japanese come here to apologize for what their forefather did to the country and the people here. So I work with all sides of the Japanese society.
Stay tuned for part two, where Zafrani Arifin from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club talks about war relics and reliving history.
When I was growing up, I was used to listen to the old people talk about their experience during the war. They were fighting on the beach when the Japanese landing, and the Indian soldiers were supposed to be chained to their pillbox. It sounds fascinating, no? So I went to the beach and see the pillbox, everything. I was a child at the time. So it grows on me, and I'm reading about this book about World War II in the Malaya. You know, it's really interesting. Then we meet other historians, and we find all these relics on the beach or research. It's very exciting to find all these things.
You've been listening to episode one of the first season of Malaysiana, our new show on heritage, culture, and all things Malaysian, right here on BFM 89.9.
Best for money. BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to episode one of the first season of Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz. We're speaking to Zafrani Arifin from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club about the Japanese landing in Kota Bharu, the starting point of the Pacific War during World War II. Zafrani, you are clearly passionate about history, especially Kelantan's part to play in World War II history. Can you tell me where your passion comes from?
My parents used to be in the war, and we grew up listening to their experience wartime. So thrilling to listen to their stories, all the hardship. But later generation, they are more distant because their age difference is very far apart. They are disconnected with the people who were in the war. So it was like an old story for them and not connecting to them at all. So what I'm trying to do is to find a way to connect this generation with their historical past.
So what's the state of these historical sites? Are they being preserved as important milestones in Malaysian history?
The British had three airfields in Malaya. Two of them are preserved because one of them is the Kota Baru Civil Airport, which are now still being used by the local airliners. So it's preserved, including the pillbox around the Kota Baru Airport now. So one still can see the British defence structures. And at the Gong Kedah Airfield, it's preserved because it is now our Royal Malaysian Air Force base there, which based the Sukhoi fighter planes. Only at Machang is not preserved, and because it's now being developed into housing. But because of this, we can go into Machang Airfield to find all these relics forgotten behind some people's house, everything. So that's how we managed to find and recover all these war relics. They are bomb craters from the first Japanese air raid in Malaya.
Why are these historical sites in such a sad state?
One thing is our own governments, they are not so keen to preserve history, especially about the colonial history side of things, because mostly our government is more likely to preserve national heritage only. So we cannot do much, but we can get people who love history to get together and do something to galvanize the public to realize that this is a very important place which changed our country and also Japan, British, all over Asia. So it's a shame because in Pearl Harbor, even there are no warship was involved at the time, people still go there just to see the place and to see the memorial of the war and managed to get about 1 million visitors per year at least.
And how many visitors does Kampung Pak Amat get for its historical past?
Nobody care about that. That's why I'm sad about this.
Today, many Malaysians have lost touch with this part of our history, with memories becoming more sketchy over the country's military past with each passing generation. Many find it hard enough to recall World War I, and the same will eventually happen with World War II as time goes by. It's been widely said that appreciation of history is low in Malaysia, no thanks to an uninspiring presentation of the subject in school. Memorization of dates and events take precedence over understanding the past and all the pain and suffering of the previous generations.
Banzai. Long live the Emperor. A huge banzai resounds throughout the empire to celebrate Japan's version of the Lightning War.
Zafrani is also part of a local reenactment group, which relive World War II events in Malaya. To create an authentic experience, much research is needed beforehand, and this helps create better awareness and understanding. These reenactments have been done for a number of reasons, including the filming of documentaries, but also because they enjoy doing it.
We had to borrow the army's weapon and everything. But at the same time, we interact with the public around us. This gave me the opportunity to tell the people about the war and history of our country during the war. When we go to the site, I invite other people who like war history to wear the Japanese army uniform. So we get together and it spread out. And while doing this in Selangor, Jandabai, during the shooting of the documentary of History Channel, people were shocked to see us guarding the old road. They thought they were seeing Japanese ghosts.
Does this help get people interested in history?
Yes, partially, because people can see with their own eyes how the Japanese looks, how the Japanese soldiers look, and how the British soldiers look. They look very different from the modern soldiers. It attracts a lot of people's attention. We go there and there, people want to take photos with us everywhere. It was a very happy time, actually. That's how we teach people about history.
This sounds like a very time-consuming interest. Why do you do this? Do you get paid for it?
Actually, I do it mostly because I love history and I also wanting to write a book about this. When I was wearing this uniform, I can feel how the soldiers were experiencing the war. not just reading a book. Reading a book doesn't give me that perspective. When you wear the uniform, you go like into the jungle. You can feel how this the advantage of having this uniform compared to the British one. The British one have a lot of more uniform. They were so heavy that they cannot move into the jungle very easily. So we know through this thing how the battle took place, the experience for the soldier at the time. So we can say, this is why the British lost and why the Japanese won.
Do you think this approach would be good to teach history in schools?
Like in other countries, people do this in classroom. That's how they teach history to the children more effectively. They're wearing army uniform, fighting mock battles on the battlefield, you know. It's more fun. And when you like to do something, people will love to do it and learn more about it. So I think we should teach history this way, especially in schools.
One of the highlights of the group's calendar is the reenactment of the Battle of Kuala Pa Amat in Kota Baru. That fateful day, on December 8, 1941, the starting point of the Japanese occupation of Malaya. It was a period that would change the country forever. If you missed the full interview with Zafrani Arifin from the Malaysian Heritage and History Club, download the podcast at www.bfm.my. Join us next Sunday at noon when we talk to Violet Slay, who was crowned the first ever Miss Malaya in 1953. You've been listening to Malaysiana with me, Nadia Aziz, on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.